talking to me?
Funny, like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead, make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer again with you.
A dragon, I swear I saw a dragon.
Good morning, I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
Lynn Venhouse.
And this is the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. Today is, I don't know, what is today,
August? The 15th.
August 15th. And Lynn Venhouse is sitting in the Michelle seat.
Good morning.
And Lynn has sat in this Michelle seat three or four times, so she does not need to be introduced. But let's introduce her anyway. Lynn writes reviews movies and reviews theater.
Writes for entertainment features.
Exactly. For the Belleville News Democrat. And she also writes for the Webster Kirkwood Times. Reviews movies over there. What did you review for the Webster Kirkwood Times last week?
Florence Foster Jenkins.
Oh, yeah? How many stars did you give that?
I gave it 3 of 4.
Did you get a Florence Foster Jenkins hair towel the other night?
I did, and thank you, you for the shout-out, too. That was nice.
Okay. Yeah, Lynn was our guest at Tenacious Eats Movies for Foodies event this past Saturday night, where we watched Julie and Julia, and she brought as her guest Jim Batts. So all three of us were at the Movies for Foodies event Saturday night, where we had to sit through Julie and Julia, a movie that I hope to go to my grave without ever having to sit through again.
Well, you know, the Liz is right. The stuff with Amy Adams is just lousy.
It is.
And I really enjoy that. Yeah, the stuff with Meryl Streep and Julia Child. I get a kick out, especially when her sister comes for a visit. That's great. Yeah.
Jane Lynch.
I'd forgotten she was in it, too.
And Stanley Tucci and Meryl Streep together are wonderful, but you forget how annoying Amy Adams is in that role as Julie Powell until you see it again. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, ooh.
We did something that was a first at Movies for Foodies. We actually watched an extra. We watched like a 30-minute making of thing that was on the DVD. That was a lot of fun. I'm glad you guys came. Did you enjoy the food?
Oh.
It was fabulous.
Yeah.
And Chef Liz is fantastic, and she gives history. Mm-hmm. And Steve Schmitz, the sous chef, and he did a wonderful profiteroles dessert.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought it would be too fancy for my taste, but I enjoyed it quite a bit.
No, this one was had a lot of meat and a lot of sauces.
Well, you know, the main dish in that movie is that bouffe bourguignon, you know, so had to have a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't tie my tongue around that too bad. Like,
that was pretty delicious. Mm-hmm. And your daughters helped. They're so cute.
Oh, yeah. Well, my older daughter was one of the servers.
Well,
but Sarah
helped eat the food there. That's right. So that was nice.
Although, and helped you deliver hand towels or hair towels.
Yeah, and she only ate about half of her food, so I got to eat 1.5 portions. And I was the MC, as I usually am, but this time I had to share MC duties with Butterscotch, the one-armed drag queen.
It was interesting.
I don't know where they got that guy from, but he had one arm, and he was a drag queen and a hairdresser, apparently. Said he sued the state of Missouri to get his hairdresser's license.
Yeah, interesting character.
He had better makeup on than I did and most of the ladies in the room.
I think he had more makeup on than all of the ladies in the room combined.
It's true. That was a fun evening.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot of fun. We had the puppets.
The Bathtub Journalists? Was that the name of the music group?
Yeah, those were the musicians. That's the first time they played. And then that's the second or third time we've had the Bob Kramer Marionettes.
Yeah,
and they're always a lot of fun.
Yeah, I saw a documentary about them for Sliff about 2 or 3 years ago. It was interesting.
Yeah,
well, the next one is going to be Ferris Bueller, and Chef Liz is going to be Abe Froman, the Sausage King. Mm-hmm. So you know what you're getting in that one.
Uh-huh.
Meat.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. That's September 10th. There's very few tickets left, apparently. That thing always sells out. All right, well, that was a lot of fun. I'm glad you guys were there. Let's talk about the top 10 at the box office, or top 12, as I like to call it these days.
Are we surprised?
Let's see.
Not too. Wait a minute.
Nine Lives is number 9. Ironically. I saw Nine Lives.
I know.
Yeah.
What you do for your art, Tom.
What I do for my daughter. My daughter wanted to see it. It really wasn't that bad. It really wasn't. It wasn't good, but it wasn't as bad as people are saying. All right, let's start with number 12, Ghostbusters. Is there going to be a sequel to Ghostbusters?
That's what the word was last week, that it's not going. It's going to take like a $70 million bath. So that's a shame, because it's a pretty decent movie. Yeah, unless people really discover it on video on demand and streaming and all that. So I'm hoping maybe that'll happen.
It only made $2.3 million.
Well, I don't get the bias, but I just thought those ladies just pulled it off. And I thought the humor was wonderful and the tributes – to the old cast was really nice, especially Harold Ramis.
I agree, but it should have starred men. All right, number 11 was Nerve 2.6. Number 10 was Lights Out. That's a horror movie that we saw.
Hanging in there pretty strong.
Still in the top 10 at 3.2. Nine Lies that I mentioned earlier. That's this goofy movie directed by Barry Sonnenfeld with Kevin Spacey as a knucklehead who comes back, or his mind comes back in the body of a cat. It's pretty stupid, but it's still in the top 10.
CGI cat, though.
Yeah. Number 8, Florence Foster Jenkins. I guess this was its first weekend opening, and it made $6.6 million. I don't know how many screens it was in. That's probably pretty good. I still haven't seen that.
Yeah. But it's an adult film. It's going to skewer to middle-aged audiences, don't you think?
And I think the ones that do go to it will have a good time. My neighbors were debating that. They wanted to see either that or Pete's Dragon. I said, go with Florence Foster Jenkins. Yeah. That's the better movie by far.
It's so wonderful to see Hugh Grant back on screen after a very long absence.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful performance.
Okay.
And the kid from Big Bang Theory is quite delightful too, Simon Helberg.
Yes, right.
And Meryl Streep, of course.
Oh, yeah. Meryl Streep. Can't go wrong with Meryl Streep. All right, let's see. Number 7 was Star Trek Beyond. Is that doing very well?
No, it's not. And the word also last week is that they've put the kibosh on the sequel to that, or the follow-up. I guess they'll be the fourth in this restarted franchise.
I thought they were going to have Kirk like meet his dad, and they're going to bring in Thor and all this stuff.
But I guess it's just underperforming, so Paramount's kind of backing away from it, so they're just going to concentrate on this new TV show.
All right, number 6 is Secret Life of Pets at $8.8 million. That's done quite well. Number 5 is Bad Moms.
Nice to see that still on the top 5.
$11.4 million. Jason Bourne, $13.6 million in fourth place. Pete's Dragon in its opening weekend made a whopping $21.5 million. I don't know how much it was expected to make, but it wasn't a super expensive movie, so it's probably on its way to a profit, I guess, eventually. Number 2, Sausage Party. We saw that. Did you see Sausage Party yet?
No, I did not. I was at the last night of the Muni.
Oh, it was very fun.
We'll talk a little more in depth about
funny,
that.
Very funny, I should say.
And number one,
Suicide Squad, yet again in number one last week, and number one again this week, although it dropped quite a bit.
Dropped $90 million bucks over the week. That's a heck of a drop, I tell you. That's probably more than...
43.8 million.
Yeah.
But it was 67% drop. So you know next week's going to be... Money does not equate quality, as we know.
And I predict Ben-Hur is going to top $300 million this weekend.
Oh, well, I do want to put money on that, though.
It will be number. I don't think Coba and the Two Strings is going to.
But I think it could do well. I think it could be in the top 5.
But it's going to be number 1. War Dogs isn't going to do that
I
well.
I think War Dogs might be number 1.
Really?
I think it could happen.
They've been
promoting the heck out of that. You know, they've just been pounding us with the trailer everywhere.
And the trailer looks kind of lame.
And Young Men Who Drive the Box Office, they love Jonah Hill and Miles Teller.
All right. Well, tonight we're seeing Coba in the Two Strings.
It's time to follow my own path. My name is Kubo. This is my story.
From Leica Studios.
They're a terrific animation.
Oh, yes. I like to see them do much better at the box office. Yeah. I've really got high hopes for this one because it's actually directed by their president, Travis Knight. Mm-hmm. So I've got my... And one of the voices is Brenda Vaccaro.
My goodness.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. I had no idea. I looked it up on IMDb.
Yeah, I saw
that
too.
She's still working there. That's great.
Wow.
Yeah. And she does have a great voice.
Nice husky voice.
You
got to hand it to Leica, though. They really sort of think outside the box in terms of their subject. I mean, what was it? Box Trolls?
Yeah. Oh, and Paranorman.
Yeah.
Which is a favorite of a lot of folks.
Yeah. And it's
Coraline.
So funny.
Coba, it looks like it's based on some Japanese legend. It looks Miyazaki influenced in some of its visuals. I don't know.
It's kind of unconventional voice casting. Charlize Theron is the voice of a monkey or like a baboon or something like that. Mm. Yeah.
I think it's going to be zen-like.
Yeah. All right. Good. Well, we'll be back next week and review that. And tomorrow night, what do you see tomorrow night, Ben-Hur?
No, I'm seeing War Dogs.
What are you seeing, War Dogs?
I'm seeing War Dogs.
Seeing Ben-Hur? I'm going to see Ben-Hur this weekend. I'm actually going to see Hell or High Water again, just because my wife wants to see it. But I would choose Ben-Hur over War Dogs if I wasn't seeing Hell or High Water.
But the best movie of the week coming out on Friday is Hell or High Water.
Hell or High Water. We'll talk about in depth finally.
But I don't know if that's going to be a big box office. I mean, it'll do well in the long run.
I think it'll be limited theaters there, probably. But the people seeing it will really have a good time with it, I think.
It's going to be a word-of-mouth movie. It'll grow, and it's going to get a ton of award season.
Jeff Bridges is a shoe-in for an Oscar nom, I think. I don't know. I guess in supporting... In the supporting role.
Well, they probably try to plug him into the best actor, probably.
Maybe. And then who's his Indian partner?
Gil Birmingham,
Maybe put him in supporting. He's really good,
too. Yeah, definitely.
But I think, I don't know, it's great. It's a great movie. We'll review it here in a minute. Let's see. I guess we can get started with our reviews. How about, let's start with, nobody saw Gleason, so let's cross that off the list. How about Indignation?
Olivia Hutton's mental history, especially in light of the circumstances.
Why did you come and stand under my window?
Because it just makes me feel like I'm making sure you're okay.
Let's start with that. Who saw that?
I did.
Okay, Lynn saw that. Lynn, what's this movie Indignation about?
Okay, it's from a Philip Roth novel, and he's a pretty intense writer if you've read Philip Roth. It's about a boy that goes to college in 1951 when the Korean War is looming, and he is from a kosher butcher shop father in Newark, New Jersey, and he goes to this very conservative university in a college in Ohio he gets into a little bit of tussle with the dean, who is played wonderfully authoritarian and scary by Tracy Letts.
We last saw in Wiener Dog.
Wiener Dog, Wiener Dog.
Is he a Tony-winning writer?
Yes, he is.
He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright.
Okay. Yes, right, playwright, yeah. And he won the Tony for playing George in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
That's right.
The revival. So he is really scary. But Logan Lerman, everybody loves him from Perks of Being a Wallflower. And he was also in Fury and those Percy Jackson movies.
Which we don't love him in.
Well, he's
quite... But I loved Alexander Daddario in those Percy Jackson movies. Okay.
Well,
surprise!
He is quite a fine young actor, and he gets into a little trouble with a girl, and she has got some issues, and she is played by Sarah...
Gadon? Is that how you pronounce her name?
I forget. Her last name now is just escaping me.
I think it's Gadon, yeah.
Okay, she's been in the last three David Cronenberg movies.
Yeah, she was in that film Enemy with Jake Gyllenhaal, if you recall. Yeah, she was the pregnant blonde in that. Yeah, and she was the paramour of Dracula in Dracula Untold.
Untold, yes. That was it. Yeah. Yeah. And that awful Map to the Stars.
I kind of like Map to the Stars.
Anyway, it's quite the drama, and it's all about a young man coming of age at a time of war.
Okay.
And he's got smothering parents.
So is it good?
Yes.
Okay. Did you review it for the Belleville News Democrat?
Yes, I did.
How many stars did you give it?
I gave it 3 of 4.
3 out of 4?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, so what's good about it?
It's a good, compelling drama with fine performances. The parents are played by Danny Burstein and Linda Emond, and they're very good Broadway actors. Mm-hmm. And so it's got a really good cast, and it's a nice adaptation of a novel. You know, because sometimes there's trouble. They need a little bit more character development, though, because you're taking a huge, chunky novel and condensing it. Ah. Always a problem.
But the period costumes are terrific and all that.
Oh, and, yes.
And the photography and all that,
And it sets the stage well.
All right. So Lynn recommends Indignation. A movie that we saw last Tuesday night was Pete's Dragon.
Is Elliot a person?
No. He looks like a dragon.
What's a dragon?
That's a dragon.
I reviewed Peach Dragon over at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. I gave it 1.5 out of 5 stars, and Jim didn't like it, and Lynn liked it a little more than Jim and I did, but I don't think anyone in this room really liked it all that much, which is a little unusual because a lot of the critics do seem to be liking Peach Dragon. I don't get it. I saw the original Peach Dragon in 1977 when I was like 14 years old, and it's not a particularly good Disney movie. I think Disney's output in the 70s was hardly their best decade.
A lot of the people, a lot of the young folks, I was talking to a woman in her 20s, and she had this past weekend, she had no idea that there was a previous film.
Yeah.
People are going to this, a lot of the audience, completely fresh. So.
Well, the first one, though, took place at the turn of the century. It's about this little boy who's living in this sort of, you know, cruel foster home straight out of, you know, Charles Dickens, and then he escapes and meets the dragon, but then he meets up with this lighthouse keeper played by Mickey Rooney, who lives in this lighthouse with his daughter, who's the local barmaid played by Helen Reddy. So it's got sort of these colorful characters. Well, this new Pete's Dragon just replaces all of those quirky characters with the most bland, generic characters you can imagine. You've got Bryce Howard is this park ranger whose job it seems to be to mark off the tree line for the local timber industry. And I guess there was supposed to be an environmental message there, but there wasn't much of a message. I mean, there was some conflict where he said, "You've gone past my lines that I drew on these trees," and that seems to be about it.
Well, she's actually engaged, I guess, to the head of the lumber company who's played by Wes Bentley.
Right.
So that's, you know, so she's a little, you know, sympathetic, but Wes is kind of sympathetic to her, you know, cause also.
It's Wes's evil brother, what was his name, Gavin?
Well, he's not too evil. He's kind of a knucklehead.
I know. He was about the least evil Disney villain. And
Carl Urban, who's so good as Bones McCoy in the new Star Trek
films. We're introduced to Pete when he's 5 years old. He's in the backseat of his parents' car. And then his mom and dad turn around. I didn't recognize these two actors, so I thought, oh, these guys are going to be dead here in about 30 seconds.
What is with Disney killing off the parents all the time?
At least it's both of them this time. Usually it's just one of them, it seems like.
Oh, my goodness. But I like your word generic, because I think so. Now, I was surprised at how one of the reasons I gave it 2.5 out of 4 stars was because it wasn't Flying Chunks of Concrete. It wasn't Bombastic Loud. It was more of a gentle, folksy approach, which some families like. And so I thought that would appeal to families who are looking for an alternative to all the bombastic action films. But the director of this is the guy that did Ain't Them Body Saints.
This is a good film.
Right. So he took a different approach.
Yeah.
It doesn't always work, I don't think, because didn't you think it was very slow?
Well, it took forever to get going, and one reason it took forever to get going is there's 3 scenes in the first half hour where people are driving in cars and these awful indie songs are playing on the radio.
Yeah.
I would have rather heard Mickey Rooney I Swear I Saw a Dragon song on the radio than these awful songs.
A dragon, a dragon, I swear I saw a dragon, a green and seething fire-breathing monster is in sight.
It's because of that the movie takes forever to get going. And then once it does get going, it's kind of wrapped up kind of quickly. They capture the dragon, they put him on a truck. You notice he's chained to the truck with like these three little thin little chains. I could have broken out of those things. And then what? And then it's over.
Yeah, my mother was telling me she was going to go take my grandniece, who's about 5 or 6, shopping, and they were going to top it off by seeing this movie. And then I talked to my mother yesterday. I said, I hope you didn't take her to Pete's Dragon. You would have been, you know, falling asleep. She says, oh, no, we took it in. We loved it.
She said, take her to see Sausage Party instead.
No. But families, I guess, for really young kids are enjoying it. But because they like the fluffy dragon. I just couldn't get over this dragon with puffs of hair on it.
And the dragon had no personality. And there was no bonding between Pete and the dragon. I mean, you really didn't care. And the whole thing sort of led up to, you know, Pete sort of tearfully hugging the dragon goodbye or whatever, but I felt nothing.
Yeah. I didn't understand how it was magical. Like, sometimes it would disappear and sometimes it wouldn't. I didn't get that. And then all of a sudden he starts breathing fire, and you didn't see that coming at all.
Except he's a dragon, so you're kind of hoping that's going to happen.
Why didn't he breathe fire when the guys were shooting the tranquilizer darts at him?
He didn't want to hurt his pal Elliot, I guess.
Yeah,
but it's just really bland, and, you know, just kind of lays there. And I spent most of my time trying to figure out what time period it was set in. You know, we figure it's maybe the mid 70s because they went out of their way to, you know, well, the pop tunes on there aren't from any are original. They aren't from any time period,
and they used real phones.
Yeah, well, they had a phone on the wall, and they avoided showing a TV set, I noticed. So so they were trying to keep it, you know, somewhere in the late 60s to mid-70s, something like that.
In the Pacific Northwest with the granola people. Mm. And then also, everybody's nice.
Oh, and Robert Redford
so
was so
nice.
Awful.
Oh, God.
But it was so dark, the photography. I think part of the problem might be that it's in 3D. Maybe it was the theater, you know, saving money on the light bulbs or something. But yeah, I think a couple of days ago, Tom, we were at a pub and I pointed out the commercial that for the film playing there, and it was so bright and you could tell what was going on. And I was like, completely unlike the screening we went to. So that really irks me when that happens.
Yeah. I thought the 3D was unnecessary.
It usually is. All right, so we do not really recommend Pete's Dragon unless you got maybe like a 5-year-old or something.
But it's at like 87% at Rotten Tomatoes. It's amazing to me. Amazing.
So. All right, but we don't like it, so it's lame. That's all that matters. All right, let's move on.
It's no Zootopia or Finding Dory.
That's for sure. Let's move on. Jim and Lynn both saw Don't Think Twice, and that stars one of those Peel and Eat guys. Is that right?
No. Well, that's your favorite of the duo there. That's Keegan-Michael Keegan-Michael Peele?
Or no, Keegan-Michael Key. He's Key.
He's Key.
So what's this about? It's about improv or something?
Yeah, it's about an improv group in New York City, and what do they call themselves? The Commune, and they perform at Improv Across America, and it's a little dump of a theater that maybe seats about 25, 30 people or something like that. They're all enjoying their moderate success. They're all having to do their day jobs, but Keegan is the one that breaks free. The big word is that they're going to have some people from Weekend Live, which is a very thinly disguised version of SNL.
Oh, yeah. Do they have a thinly disguised version of John Belushi?
No, it's how the dynamic changes when one of them breaks out and the other ones don't. But it's written and directed by Mike Birbiglia, and he is a genuine genius comedian, and he acts in films. He was in Trainwreck as Brie Larson's husband. He wrote the movie Sleepwalk with Me a couple years ago, and he came to the pageant for stand-up, and we got to interview him, and he's just a really sharp, funny, nice person, and so you get his humor. You know, he's not really super crude.
Is he in this movie?
He's
got a wonderful role in it.
Okay.
Yeah, he's the observational kind of humor. And all these people in it, a lot of them are famous from writing things like Inside Amy Schumer and Broad City, Garfunkel and Oates, those kind of Comedy Central shows. So a lot of them are, they're not household names, but the people that know comedy know them. Kate Micucci, she's in another period. Gillian Jacobs, who is in Community.
And a great show on Netflix called Love. Terrific show. And, well, what tickled me is Keegan-Michael Key's character is named Jack Mercer. And you know who Jack Mercer is. So I was really tickled by that. I said,
fill us in, Jim. Who is Jack Mercer?
By Tom Baskin. You don't know who Jack Mercer is? It's Popeye.
Oh, okay.
That's a cartoon character.
All right, so let me ask you this. I haven't seen Don't Think Twice. Is the improv that these characters do funny?
Sometimes.
Sometimes it's intentionally supposed to be bad.
Yes.
It's like the Upright Citizens Brigade in New York City, where they pay $5 for the shows, and this is where Amy Poehler broke out, Ed Helms, a lot of SNL people, a lot of people in sitcoms now, and so it's very much like that. Mm-hmm. But their goal is to be on Weekend Live.
So that's the most telling scene in the movie is when Keegan-Michael Key, without spoiling too much, he lands a spot on Weekend Live, and he tells his castmates there, his Commune fellows, about it at a restaurant. One of them, which is a student, is like a 22-year-old, is excited and loves it and is, you know, congratulating him. The rest of them look like they just got hit with a bag of hammers. They're so disappointed that it's not them getting chosen that they can't be happy for their friends. So that's a very telling scene.
It's one of those follow your dreams.
Did you review it for the Belleville New Democrat?
I did.
How many stars did you give it?
I gave it 3 of 4.
Did you review it, Jim?
I believe Michael reviewed that for us, and you did a great review. I think he gave it a pretty high rating, as I recall. I can't recall if it was 3.5 or 4, but it's really interesting. Once Keegan does get on Weekend Live, he decides he's going to try to get his friends' gigs on there as writers, and finally the big boss, he says to him, says, don't... be concerned about yourself. Don't worry about bringing your friends on board. So it's funny, but it's tough, you know, and it's really, really hard to look at showbiz.
All right.
And I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
All right. So Jim and Lynn recommend Don't Think Twice. So don't think twice about going to see Don't Think Twice. All right. Speaking of funny, we saw Sausage Party last week.
Oh, it's beautiful, man. It's just beautiful.
As soon as you're out those doors.
Oh, Jesus, fuck!
The gods kill our asses.
You fucking whore! Me eyes, they burn a little.
Please, no, I haven't got the familia!
Yes, we
Sausage
did.
Sausage Party is actually a very, very funny movie.
Jim
reviewed it for WeirdMovieGeeks.com and gave it 4 out of 5 stars. I would probably give it, about 4 or 5 stars as well. It's ultra vulgar.
Oh, ultra. Boy, they bombard you with those F-bombs right away as soon as it starts.
I might have to see it again because I think I missed half of the jokes because the audience we saw it was laughing so darn hard.
Oh, yes. They were screaming with laughter.
Is it written by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg?
Seth Rogen, with help from Jonah Hill and a couple of other fellas helped out. Ariel Shafar and Kyle Hunter, who's helped out on some of the other Seth Rogen
And also apparently helped by some really good weed.
Oh, well,
doubt. From what I've heard.
Well, is it the usual stable of Seth Rogen compadres?
Oh, yeah. James Franco's in there.
And Danny McBride.
And Michael Chena.
Sarah.
I heard Edward Norton was in it.
He does Woody Allen.
As Sammy Bagel Jr.
Yeah.
That tickled me.
But isn't Selma Hayek a lesbian taco show?
Teresa Taco. And she lusts after Bridget the Bun, who's played by Kristen Wiig.
I don't understand why the hot dogs weren't kept in refrigerators.
Unless they had some sort of little coolant thing in that big display. They were in the red, white, and blue display because it's right on the eve of Fourth of July. Yes.
But it's not really about food, is it?
No, sort of.
They sneak in some messages in there. That I'm blindsided by the fact that they have this really scathing commentary about the nature of religion. And the thing is that the foodstuffs are told by, I think it's the Indian chief, Firewater, played by Bill Hader. Said they were all miserable because they knew they were going to be taken home and eaten. So he concocted this thing that the people buying them were gods, and they were going to, if they were selected, they were taken to Nirvana, like a heavenly place. And this kept them kind of placated. And of course, when Michael Cera and the dolls get to the woman's kitchen, it's like a slasher movie. It's like, the worst torture porn ever. So I was like, and Seth Rogen's character, Frank, is kind of conflicted about, he really wants to tell everybody the truth, but he knows they'll just make everyone just feel awful if they know what their eventual fate is. So this was a really interesting, and you have the option of going to hell. That's what happens when you reach your expiration date and the store manager comes around with a big barrel of garbage can and you're shoved into there and it's like a black pit that you're never heard from again.
When my older daughter was little, we used to see these VeggieTales movies. They were about talking vegetables, but they were Christian. They were Christian-based films, and these veggies would talk about God, and there was all these Christian themes around there. I sort of saw this movie as turning the whole VeggieTales thing on its head. Although I doubt too many people who are laughing at this movie are aware of VeggieTales.
Yeah.
But it certainly made me think of it.
That was my only fault with it. It kind of screeches to a halt while Bridget and Frank have a theological discussion. I was like, no, let's get back to the poop jokes and the getting high jokes. And all.
It does wear you down a little bit.
The one character, the villain in it, and I don't know if we should say his name. He's a feminine hygiene product. He gets to be a little much. After a while, he's so angry all the time. But there's some great moments in it.
In the condom. Don't forget the condom. Talking condom.
The zombie corn, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, I got to salute them. They wanted that R rating, and by golly, they go for it in the last 10 minutes or so. There is the most unbelievable orgy sequence that, would have been quadruple NC-17 if it was people doing all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was really, really surprised me. Again, so they, if you're going to, do an R-rated animated film, do one, and they certainly did.
Mm-hmm. So is it a niche film?
Apparently not. I mean, it made $33.6 million. I don't think it cost much more than that to make. Maybe it cost less than that to make.
Yeah.
You would think it would be, but apparently it's striking a chord with mainstream audiences.
Yeah, well, and it's from a major studio, yeah. So I'm really surprised with the subplot that they're kind of kicking the hornet's nest by doing this. But yeah, it's pretty well done. Actually, one of the directors of one director, his resume is pretty much Thomas the Tank Engine stuff.
Oh, wow.
And the other one is from DreamWorks Animation, worked on The Last Madagascar and Monsters vs. Aliens and that sort of thing. So, this was quite a surprise. I knew that there would be a lot of gross jokes, but when you see the commercial, you think it's going to be all about them trying to get out of this kitchen, but
I thought more was going to take place in the lady's house.
Yeah, and like I say, it's got some great voice work. I kind of like the look of it, too. Being an artist, I kind of appreciate it. It had sort of a retro feel. It looked like one of the old Betty Boop cartoons where stuff would all of a sudden spring, mouths and arms and legs would spring up.
One of the old advertisements you'd see at the drive-in for the food at the snack bar or something.
Let's go up to the bingo. Lobby.
And Shopwells is the name of the place in it. Yeah, and it has a real underground comic sensibility to it, too, which I kind of appreciated. Yeah. So, James Franco is the druggy guy in it, and that subplot's pretty funny.
That is pretty funny.
He's
on bath salts.
I know it's
in his toilet paper.
See what goes on in there. But it's, if you can handle it, if you're not sensitive or easily offended, I say take it in,
If you are easily offended, I say take it in anyway.
go see Pete's Dragon, because there's absolutely nothing that will offend you in that.
Wusses.
Or interest you in it.
Right? All right, let's move on. So Jim and I really like Sausage Party, and Lynn's going to go see it this week. All right, let's move on. A movie that the three of us saw like 3 months ago.
Yeah.
Hell or
high
water. It
was a toad dip.
Woo! You hear about these bank robberies? You may get to have some fun before they send you off to the rocking chair yet.
I may have one hunt left in me.
Mama, hasn't that been a while?
3 months.
Bank breathing down her neck.
Everybody get on the ground!
Yeah.
Hell or High Water, which stars Ben Foster and Chris Pine from Star Trek, as two brothers down in Texas, and they are robbing banks because the banks, they own their mother's home, and Chris Pine wants to drill for oil on the mother's home.
Yeah, it's a real interesting kind of scheme that these two guys have concocted. It's these guys got a little bit in their noggin. Pretty smart.
It's in West Texas, and fun fact: Bonnie and Clyde came from that environment in West Texas.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's post economic downturn recovery.
Yeah, there's a lot of speeches about that.
Well, whenever they show them driving through some place, you see these signs off the side of the road. Bankrupt? We can help all these vultures picking at the bones of everybody down there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really a fitting modern tale. But Chris Pine and Ben Foster are so good as the brothers. Chris Pine probably delivers the best performance of his career. Mm-hmm. And Ben Foster is always spot on, nails it.
All the characters are good. I mean, even the little characters. Like, the very beginning, there's this woman who walks into the bank, the very first scene, and she gets right. But I can picture that woman, even though I saw this movie 3 months ago. All the characters are memorable. The little characters, like the waitress, the chubby waitress that they're flirting with.
Well, the T-bone waitress. Yeah. She's fantastic. Yeah. Said, we only got T-bones. What do you want?
But performance-wise, towering over this film is an incredible performance by Jeff Bridges. He's a shoo-in for an Oscar nom. It's just a matter of whether he's in the supporting or the lead category. Is the sheriff. Now, he's on the verge of his retirement, and he gets this one big case, just weeks before he retires, which is a very cliche character. But if that character is done as well as it is in this movie, it's a great character.
And the relationship with him and his partner, they're played by Gil Birmingham.
Yes.
Yeah, who's playing Alberto, who's like half Mexican, half Native American. Mm-hmm. And, Bridges is kind of needling him,
There's some casual racism from Jeff Bridges' character. But he takes it in good spirit.
The guy's really like
like each other.
You know, they respect each other.
And they've got this great relationship. Gil Birmingham, you might not recognize his name, but he has been around for many years as a journeyman actor. But he's best known for the Twilight movies. He's Billy Black. He's Jacob's dad and Bella's dad, Charlie's best friend. So that's his breakout role. But in this, he and Jeff Bridges have a wonderful relationship. And
well, they're like a little married couple almost,
They are, and their sense of duty and their sense of injustice. And the justice here isn't so black and white. That's what the script is by Taylor Sheridan, who wrote Sicario.
An actor, by the way,
Yeah, he's getting a lot of acclaim for this, as he did for Sicario. And
you know, and it is directed with such a great feel for the atmosphere, for the time and the place and the characters. For August to have a character-driven movie be this great.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's directed by a British fellow named David McKenzie.
Yes.
Who did Young Adam a few years back. You might remember that. But I was surprised at that it was a foreigner. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they look at things with fresh eyes and really bring something new to it. But yeah, it is a terrific film. I remember a few years ago somebody was telling me, "Oh, I hate critics because they just love to rip into movies and tell you about bad movies." I said, no, we like to tell you about good movies. Well, this makes all the bad movies worth it when we can tell you about something as great as this. And it's not going to get a lot of press. It's not going to get a lot of commercials or magazine ads. So we like to promote it. The word of mouth is going to be great on it. It's only going to be in a few theaters, probably.
And the word from our mouths is it's a great movie. And I will be reviewing Hell or High Water this Thursday night at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. Did you want to say one more thing?
I was going to say it's got 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Well, it's going to get 100% from me, doggone it, because I'm going to give it 5 out of 5 stars. So look for my review
Thursday night. I'll give it 155%.
We're arguing over who liked it more. So that's always a good sign.
From 4 stars from me.
Hell or High Water, we highly, highly, highly recommend.
Yes.
Okay, let's talk about a few local things. This weekend, midnight at the Tivoli, and noon on Saturday is The Sandlot.
Now he's in.
Yeah! All right!
With the coolest guys in the neighborhood. They've got the look.
Wendy Peppercorn.
Wow.
Hey, girls.
They've got the moves. They've got the rap.
Blockhead! Geek! Jerk!
I love that movie.
Everybody loves that movie.
Yeah, from 93. I didn't realize it was that old. Yeah.
It's kind of like Christmas Story in some ways.
Yeah, yeah.
Very nostalgic.
Now, I was looking it up on IMDb. Is the lifeguard, is that Marley Shelton from Sin City, future star of that?
Yeah, and Grindhouse.
Grindhouse, wow. Now, is Dennis Leary, as I recall, is he the narrator of it, I guess?
Who's that actor?
He's married to Deborah Winger. He's Leslie Howard's relation. Arliss Howard?
Yes, Arliss Howard. Arliss Howard.
Dennis Leary plays the kid's father. Karen Allen is his mom.
I didn't see Howard enlisted in the IMDb credits. That was odd.
All right. Well, maybe it's like a surprise because he kind of doesn't show up till the very end. Anyway, that's Sandlot. It's a great movie. Midnight Friday. I'll be there with lots of prizes and Sandlot trivia, et cetera, et cetera. Last night, I went out to the Gravois Bluffs and saw Animal House.
Another Fathom event.
Second funniest movie next to Airplane, in my opinion.
It really holds up well. Yeah. It's so politically incorrect. I hadn't seen it. You know, I've watched that. I got that 800-foot Super 8, which I probably the last 3 or 4 times I've watched Animal House, I've watched this 35-minute condensed version. But I tell you, there's some stuff they could not get away with, like where they go to the Jewish Dickinson school and pick up the 4 girls take them to the all-black roadhouse.
Oh, that's so wonderful. I was watching it late night one time, and I came in right before Tim Matheson goes to the college and concocts the story. And you have to
Von Leibowitz.
And I could not go to bed till I saw that whole thing. And
Coed killed and kiln explosion?
And can
she
we?
She was making me a pot.
And he's like, can we dance with your dates?
Oh, yeah, you should hate Tim Matheson's character after that, but you don't. It's like, this is a really low-class thing to do, but it kind of makes it more endearing somehow.
Then in the roadhouse, Flounder says to his date, she goes, what's your major? And she says, primitive cultures. And then they cut to Otis Day up there singing. You could not get away with that now.
Now, that is supposed to be a club in East St. Louis.
Is that right?
Because Harold Ramis wrote it when he was at Wash U. So it's really like they go across the river.
But they're picking up on these Fathom Events things. It looks like they're having them every week now.
Yeah, but you said there was a good audience there last night. Yeah.
The last three or four times I went out to the Chesterfield, and there was like three or four people. So last night I decided to go to the Graboid Bluffs because I wanted to see Animal House with the crowd. There was like 30 or 40 people. So
now they're going to run this again on Wednesday, aren't they, Animal House?
Yeah, I think it's Wednesday. Yeah, yes, they do it Sundays and Wednesdays at 2 o'clock and 7 o'clock. And then this Sunday they're doing another one, Thelma and Louise. Which is a movie I haven't seen in a couple of decades.
Not as funny as Animal House.
No, I wonder how, I'm kind of curious how that holds up. It won the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay.
And female wrote it.
Yeah, Callie Couric was her name. She did the Ya-Ya Sisterhood. And then she kind of disappeared after that.
Right, and that's known as Brad Pitt's breakout role.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's true. 91. Wow. Yeah, Ridley Scott. That was an interesting choice for him to kind of get away from the space stuff or the historical epics and get something that's contemporary like that.
So I spent the weekend watching old movies. I see new movies during the week and old movies on the weekend. Friday night I saw Dr. Butcher, M.D. over at the Moolah.
Yeah, you saw that Friday night, did you?
Yeah, Saturday night apparently they had technical difficulties. They couldn't show it. I don't know what happened.
Did they just run it over in the bar area or something?
Yeah, apparently. Yeah, I guess everybody got their money back, which was too bad, but
those
kind
of
things happen. Next month, they're showing I Drink Your Blood. You ever seen that, Lynn? I Drink Your Blood. It's really good, actually. Lynn Lowry stars in it. She's a really good horror actress who's worked with Cronenberg and George Romero. And it's about this gang of hippies that move into this small town, and they're kind of rude to this boy's parents. So he injects rabies from this dead dog into these meat pies and serves these meat pies to these hippies, so these hippies get rabies and go around killing and eating people. When I was a teenager, they ran some really gory photos. It wasn't Famous Monsters. I think it was Castle of Frankenstein, where they ran some gory photos from this movie, so I was really excited. And I went, and then a couple years later, they played it at the Holiday Drive-In, so I go to the Holiday Drive-In to see it, and this print had all the gore cut out of it.
Oh,
I mean,
like with
a pair of scissors, I'd be like, clunk, and then the scene would be over, and I'm like, oh my god. So I didn't see that uncut for a couple decades after that, but it's really good.
Did Joe Bob Briggs ever show it on Monster Vision?
Probably not. I don't think they showed that extreme gore stuff, and it probably wasn't restored at that time. I think they didn't restore it till a decade after Joe Bob was doing his stuff on TNT.
I talking about horror films, I was flipping the dial yesterday, and I think the Comet Channel was running Grave of the Vampire.
Oh yeah, with William Smith.
And I checked the credits. You know who wrote that?
No.
David Chase.
Oh, yeah.
The Sopranos guy.
Yeah,
that was like his first one of his first screen credits.
That's a great movie.
Yeah, that was a lot of real interesting cast. A lot of people that I've seen in other things. It was pretty neat.
All right. See, also locally, my 16mm double feature night is September 6th, and I am showing Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry. You ever seen that one, Lynn?
I have not.
Oh, Peter Fonda and Susan George and Roddy McDowell and Adam Rourke and Vic Morrow. That's great. It's one of the great car chase movies from the mid-70s. And double feature with The 4D Man, Robert Lansing, in a science fiction movie made in 1959. So that's September 6th. I'll talk about that
from the director of The Blob, right?
That's right. Yes. Irving Yerworth is his name. He did The Blob, then he did The 4D Man, then he did Dinosaurus right after that, and then he kind of disappeared.
those are
fun movies, though. Yeah. Dinosaurus is a riot.
That's a hat trick. I heard one.
All right. Speaking of horror movies, Jim and I saw a private, special, top-secret screening of a movie called Eyes of Fire Thursday night. This is really interesting.
It was a time of witchcraft.
Rish ahead! Rish ahead!
Of hangings.
Rish ahead!
Of horror.
Ahead.
Of magic. They were outcasts on a desperate voyage to the promised land. What they found was a terrifying world.
In 1983, I went to the movie theater and I saw this movie called Eyes of Fire, and it was this horror movie shot in the Ozarks. And when I saw The Witch earlier this year, it kind of reminded me of Eyes of Fire because it takes place in the mid-18th century, and it's about these Puritans that are cast out from their commune and sent out into the woods, and then there's all these demons and witches and things living in the trees and the woods. And the movie always stuck with me. I never forgot it, but I never saw it again. And then about 3 or 4 years ago, I was in Chris Clark's office, and on the floor of his office, there was this film can, and it said Eyes of Fire. And I go, what the heck is this? He goes, it's a 35mm print of Eyes of Fire. And I'm like, oh my god, I saw that movie in 1983. And Chris was like, I did too. So I kind of forgot about it again. And then Michael Hafner pointed out that they had showed Eyes of Fire double feature with The Witch in a retrospective on movies about witches earlier this year over in California somewhere. And he asked me if I was familiar with this movie. And that sort of lit a fire under my butt. And I contacted Chris again. I go, we should show this at SLIFT. There's this whole St. Louis connection with it being filmed in the Ozarks. And Chris said, yeah, we can do that, but we need to kind of check out the print. So last Thursday night, we sort of test drove the 35 millimeter print to kind of see what kind of shape it was in. And
darn good shape.
It was in fantastic shape. And the movie was better than I remembered it. It's definitely trippier and weirder than I remember. It's got all these early 80s techniques like solarization and these
negatives
optical. Putting the negatives in to get these horror effects. But it works. I mean, it's sort of cheesy, but it's not something you see very often. Yeah, the print was in fantastic shape, and we're going to show it again in November at part of the St. Louis International Film Festival, and I will be introducing that. And I've been trying to track down the director. They said if we can track down the director and invite him, they're willing to fly him in to host the film, but apparently this guy isn't really interested.
Yeah, well, some interesting faces, familiar faces in the cast. Guy Boyd, Dennis Lipscomb, Rob Paulsen, Fran Ryan. Mm-hmm. So Fran Ryan was the woman in the cab at the start of The Stripes. It was back of Bill Murray's cab.
Yeah, Dennis Lipscomb apparently passed away. Yeah, he was the star,
Yeah, little main guys in it. But I think I recognize, you remember the Inquisitor at the start of it, the sort of framing device there, the fellow with the mustache? I have to look up the actor's name, but he was the police chief on the 1990 Flash TV show.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I was like, I know that guy.
Avery Krauts was the guy who wrote and directed this film, and apparently his grandfather founded the Tonka Toy Company, and his father founded this big shipping company in Paducah, Kentucky, which is a big river town. And so I kind of got the impression that this Avery Krauts guy dabbled in photography and art and filmmaking. Maybe he was a trust funder, I imagine. And he didn't really make any other films, although he directed something called The Invisible Kid, according to IMDb. Apparently, he doesn't seem to be too interested in getting back to me. I know he knows that. I had a relative hand over my contact information, but I haven't heard back from him. So we're still going to show it, though, doggone it.
He's done with that part of his life.
I guess.
Who knows?
All right. Eyes of Fire, we'll talk about that more, but that'll be showing in November at the Webster University as part of the St. Louis International Film Festival. Let's see. Kenny Baker died. Oh, my gosh. You know, if you think about it, the primary cast of Star Wars, even though it's almost 40 years old, are still with us, except for Alec Guinness and Peter Cushing were old men when they made the movie. But everybody else is survived.
Yeah.
But, Kenny Baker certainly seems to be the first one of these guys to pass away. How old was he?
He was 81.
And he was a little midget guy. He was also in Labyrinth.
I have him down as being an Amadeus, the Elephant Man. Of course, he was Fidget in The Time Bandits, so he's one of the Time Bandits, a major Terry Gilliam film.
Great film.
And I saw listed as his first film, 1960's Circus of Horrors.
Oh, yeah, with Anton Differing.
Yes. So, Mona Lisa, this guy's, of course, he was in Willow.
Yvette Munlauer was the female in it.
Yeah, and Yvonne Romaine, I believe, from Curse the Werewolf.
There you go,
that
she's
too.
Oh,
my goodness, yes.
That's a good one, all right.
Yeah, so, Kenny, he had a big career aside from Star Wars, but, he's immortal because of R2-D2, that's for sure.
I don't know if he did. Did he do the autograph scene like some of those other guys did, like Peter Mayhew?
I think he did hit some conventions. I heard he'd been in poor health the last year or two, and that's why he didn't make the big one that was this past year. But, I think he hit a few of them, like Dave Prowse did for a while.
Yeah. All right, so RIP, little guy, Kenny Baker. Lynn contributed to our top 21 of the 21st century list a couple weeks ago.
Didn't
you see that? You know, I was looking at all those lists. We polled 30 local film critics and film bloggers and film fans, and everybody put their top 10 lists, and then I sort of put it all together and came up with the top 21. I was looking at all the individual lists, and I came to the conclusion that my list was the best.
Well, I'm shocked.
No, really. Of all the lists, mine's the best.
Yeah. I'm partial to mine, but I'm the only one who mentioned 28 Days Later in Nebraska. But what I found telling about all 30 is that most everybody mentioned a lot of the same directors. Mm-hmm. It just was a different film.
True. Yeah. Very few horror films, though. You had 28 Days Later. I had The Devil's Rejects. Ian McDonald had Cabin in the Woods. But besides that, although the number one movie, Mulholland Drive, actually has some horror elements. And so does Pan's Labyrinth, I guess.
And very few comedies, too.
Well, I remember somebody on Facebook said, is there an Animal House for this new century? And on my list was 40-Year-Old Virgin, and I almost put in Bridesmaids, so I think somebody else had mentioned Superbad, so
there have been
sort of contenders to that crown.
Well, there were some movies with comedic elements. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? You'd have to consider.
Oh, it's very funny.
Well, my son Tim put Superbad on his top 10.
And Lynn had Mulholland Drive as number one, as did your friend Rob Garcia, and that ended up being number one on the overall top 21 list.
Well, I think we wanted to take into context how you felt the first time you saw it, and if you've seen it repeated times, and how it affects you when you see it again. Because to me, that's a movie, you know, if you can watch a movie again and get fresh things out of it, it's just a wonderful experience. Plus, it's just what hits you. You know, I remember watching Mulholland Drive and just being blown away by how different it was and how electric it was. Oh, and I watched it three times that weekend.
Yeah, it's David Lynch's masterpiece, I think.
Oh,
yeah, but I think I mentioned before, people always accuse us of being elitist. And so, of course, I was accused of that when I gave Warcraft like a one star or whatever. But I think you mentioned there's only one foreign language film in there.
Pan's
and there's,
Labyrinth,
there's some, you know, Best Picture winners. There's some big box office hits. So it's a pretty great list.
Yeah, it is a great list. But, you know, there's interesting some of the Best Picture winners that didn't make anybody's list. Spotlight wasn't on anybody's list. Argo wasn't on anybody's list.
Slumdog Millionaire wasn't. Yeah. The King's Speech.
I had Life of Pi number 2 on my list, and shockingly, nobody else had it on their list.
Well,
I
it is it's a wonderful movie in Ang Lee, but I think everybody was, if they did put Brokeback Mountain on there, I think that was the Ang Lee people were going with.
Yeah, I'm not sure if anybody put the Crash that won over that.
Nobody put Crash.
Nobody put Crash.
Oh, did? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, nobody. I don't think anybody put
Crash. Yeah, no, I don't think so either. Well, I did have some of those that you mentioned about, you know, in the, like I did a top 25 for my own self. But that's the thing, you got to make a cut. And it was like, what do you think was most impactful?
Yeah.
And speaking of comedies, the Lego Movie was number one on two of our fellow critics.
And they were that Lego Movie was only on those two lists.
Yeah, I know.
Right?
But it's still, because it was number one on two lists, it got 20 points and was barely in the top 21. I think it was number 20.
Yeah, I was surprised that certain films on my list somebody else agreed with. I think somebody else had American Splendor on their list, and I think Ian had Spider-Man 2 on there.
Yeah, and I had Apocalypto on my list, Mel Gibson's Apocalypto, and that ended up pretty high on Dana Young's list as well.
And I had 500 Days of Summer, which is a fabulous romantic comedy. And yeah, Max and Carl had it on theirs too. My son, interestingly enough, his was, we shared some of the same ones, which are usually, you know, he's 31, so it's different. But it's funny how, like, when you watch films with your family, you know, and how they get impacted by it. I just think that's interesting.
Yeah, so go to weirdmoviegeeks.com and look up the top 21 of the 21st century's list. You know, maybe I'll put that on the Weird Movie Geeks podcast Facebook page again tonight, so it'll be easy to find.
And if you like that, read my top 10 funny ladies of the movies list. So that went up last week, too.
Yeah, we're going to talk about ladies here in a second. Speaking of funny ladies, Lynn, you belong to some group of female film critics, is that right?
Yes.
Tell us about this. You've come up with a list of the top Wonder Women or something. Tell me about this.
Right. In honor of Wonder Woman's 75th anniversary last year and in honor of Alliance of Women Film Journalists' 10th anniversary, they decided to compose a list of the Wonder Women of film. We had to pick our favorite female characters, the ones that live on in the hearts and minds of people long after the movie ends. So this was an arduous task. Now, locally, Michelle McHugh and Kate Marquis of your site are in the group. It's Martha Baker, Diane Carson, Sandy Olmsted, Kate, Michelle, and I. We're the local members. And it's a national group. You'll recognize some of the national critics in it. And so we had to do 100. And then they put a master list of 250. And then we had to cut it down to 55. So every Monday in August, we have been revealing 11. So we've gone from 54 down to 43, down to, 32. And then this week, it's 33 to 23. And you'll be happy to know that Pam Grier did make it at 21 for Jackie Brown.
There should have been three or four Pam Grier characters in that list. But I'm not going to be happy. But that's fine. I love Pam Grier. I do love Jackie Brown. She's a great character.
She is a great character. Well, Kate and I are the only ones that contributed blurbs. They ask us who would like to write about the characters. So I wrote about three, and Kate wrote about three. So
who else did you write about?
Jane Craig, Broadcast News, Alice Hyatt, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, and Hermione in the Harry Potter movies. Mm-hmm. Those were mine. So mine were 47, 35, and 26. Kate is her first one got in today. It's Sounder, Rebecca, Cicely Tyson's character in Sounder. And then she's going to write about two more. I don't know if I should reveal them.
Okay, you don't have to.
But she's going to do Clarice in Silence of the Lambs and a Maude of Harold and Maude.
But so no Russ Meyer character.
No, but
not
Princess...
Erica Gavin in Vixen or Kit Natividad in Beneath the Veil, the Ultra Vixens.
No, but it's a whole...
Tora Satana.
It's a whole range
those are tough
of...
Women.
It's a whole range of females. It's okay. Princess Leia, Scout from To Kill a Mockingbird.
Are you going back to the 30s and 40s?
Yeah, we have... what's the Marlene Dietrich? The Blue Angel. We have Ninotchka, Greta Garbo. Garbo's character in Ninotchka, and Barbara Stanwyck's character in Lady Eve.
All right. So where can we find this list?
Oh, it is on awfj.org. Alliance of Women Film Journalists.
All right.
I'm so sorry.
All right. That's okay. That's okay. We got to wrap this up, though. Doggone it. It seems like we just started. All right. Yeah. We'll be back last week. We'll review Coba and the Two Strings and Ben-Hur and War Dogs and talk about all kinds of other stuff. Oh, but for now, we got to wrap it up. I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
Lynn Venhouse.
And listen again next week.
A dragon. I swear I saw a dragon. A green and seething, fire-breathing monsters in sight.
Black leather, rock.
Black leather, ta-ta-ta.
Oh, naughty state.
Hello, dog.
Black leather, rock. Black leather, ta-ta-ta. Black leather, hip, hip, hip. I got that feeling. Black leather, rock.